So my name is Daniel Villegas, and I love Harley Davidsons. My wife just bought me one, and I've been driving it for about a year, and it's amazing.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness of wrongful conviction. Today, we're going to hear the story of Daniel Villegas, who went to prison as a child and was released well into adulthood. Just a warning, there's some adult language and content about sexual abuse and violence in prison. I also want to tell you another story about a man who is still incarcerated for murder. Not here, though. I've created a new podcast. It's called Convicted. It's a 10-episode series, and the twists and turns and injustice in the case are unbelievable. I'll play the trailer for you near the end before the credits. This episode is being brought to you by Blue Apron, the podcast Serial Killers, and Spring. While sitting here with my spring boots on, smelling my Blue Apron cooking downstairs, and queuing up my podcast list for my walk later, I can't help but be thankful for all of the sponsors that support mine and other podcasts. I love that Blue Apron supports so many podcasts because their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They've established partnerships with over 150 local farms, ranchers, and fisheries across the United States. And that sustainable food can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. Plus, waste is reduced because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient. In my most recent Blue Apron experience, I had my box shipped to me out of town in a condo I was staying at, so I could share the deliciousness with my travel companions. They are now Blue Apron subscribers. It helps me to stay on my budget too, because cooking a Blue Apron meal is so much cheaper than going out, and the food is just as delicious. I mean, spending under $10 per person per meal, who could beat that? And judging by next week's menu of Parmesan crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli, and with sweet and sour salmon with bok choy and carrot and ginger fried rice, I love the flexibility and ease of using Blue Apron, and that every box is guaranteed. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/actual. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/actual. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Daniel is such an amazing person, and he tells his story so well. I continue to be impressed by his positivity and integrity. But you don't have to take my word for it, because here's Daniel's story.
I grew up in a Christian family, for the most part. I mean, my grandma was like a zealous Christian, and she told, you know, they went to go what they call in the Protestants, they have what they call, they'll present the babies to God, what they do. So, they presented me to God, and then this lady started speaking in tongues, and then, somebody interpreted, and then they said I was going to be a preacher, which I haven't been a preacher yet. But, and so from then on, I was like sealed, my grandma's favorite from then on out. And I kind of grew up in that environment. You know, I mean, my parents were a little different. They were like off and on, you know, they would party a lot and, you know, have, you know, a lot of their friends over and stuff. And then, my dad was into race cars and stuff. So, you know, all around our house, we'd always have race cars. And then he had his race car and, he had all kinds of different race cars himself. So then they would like get to a point in their life where they'll be like, oh no, we're going to change our lives. And then they'll go to church and then everything else, you know, they'll be real strict with us. And then before you know it, they'll stray off and then they'll go back to the party life. You know, just like that, you know, off and on. And, but like with my grandma, like I said, she was such a zealot that, you know, she'd always would take me to all these different churches to see if I like them. I remember one time, you know, I told her I like Asian women. So, you know, she found a church with nothing but Asian women. And then she's like, hey, I got this church. You know what I mean? You got a lot of Asian women. What you like? And that's how I was brought up. You know, I was brought up in the, you know, rock and roll and fast cars for the most part. And then, you know, my grandma was always the, you know, the peacetime and going to Whataburger. She had this place in Northeast where a Whataburger that knew us. They always used to give us free stuff and everything. And, you know, she'd have her Bible lessons with us there. And that was my life as a child.
What led to the circumstances that you were wrongfully accused? What was your path like at that time?
I mean, there was this one spot that we would hang out at. It was called the Devil's Triangle. And that little spot by itself in 1993 had more murders in that little area than all El Paso have in a year. You know, so we moved from Central to that area. And then, you know, it's like hard to explain to people, you know, so they can get an idea. But when I was growing up, you know, it wasn't like the, you know, the jocks and all that weren't the popular kids, you know, in my area. You know, it was the ones that were in the gangs and stuff. Those were the popular ones. Those were the ones that everybody wanted to be with. The jocks were like nerds, kind of, you know? You know, that's how I got involved in a lot of wrong people. You know, I got in my area, especially. I mean, it was so infested. It was, you know, it was crazy. In Central El Paso, where I was at, I had a speech impediment when I was a child. And back then, they didn't know about this type of thing. So what they thought was that I didn't know English. So they put me in an international class, you know, where it's about, so they're teaching me in Spanish and trying to teach us English and stuff. And, you know, so a lot of them kids, you know, would pick on me a lot. You know, they would bully me when I was, you know, from, you know, kindergarten to fifth grade. And, you know, they always tell me, you know, oh, you're not Mexican, you're white. Because, you know, I'm light complected with red hair. And then, so they, you know, they'll bully me, and I used to get picked on a lot. I mean, it was to the point where my mom was a PTA member at that school, and I remember one time, you know, she seen this kid getting beat up, so she went over there to stop the fight, and then come to find out the kid that she was helping with her son, how bad it was.
I also have red hair, and I'm light complected, if that makes you feel better.
Oh, yeah, I remember. I seen you. Yeah, so that, I mean, that's what happened. I mean, I was bullied a lot, and, right at my fifth grade year is, hey, we're going to move out of here. So we moved to the Northeast. And then when we moved there, I said, well, this is a, you know, this really sucks. You know, I finally got everybody to like me, and then now we're moving. So, but when I got there, I thought to myself, I'm not going to be bullied. You know, it's a new slate. I won't be bullied no more. You know, I'm going to go in there, you know, with a no-nonsense type attitude. And that's what I did. I went in there with a no-nonsense type attitude, didn't get bullied, and then, you know, so people recognized that, and then that's how I got attached to the wrong crowd. And from there, you know, I just escalated.
Can you tell me what the crime you were accused of was?
I was convicted of a capital murder. It was a drive-by shooting involving four individuals, and out of the four, two got killed and two survived.
Why did the police even consider you as a suspect?
That we're still trying to figure out exactly how they got my name. You know, because the name, okay, the first person that they picked up was my cousin, which was David Rangel. And, you know, David, he lived in the Lower Valley, which is another part of town. So, they went to him and there, and then, you know, they tried to accuse him of the crime. And then he was like, oh, my cousin was bragging about that, whatever. And, but what the problem with that is, I don't know how they got him out of everybody. I mean, you could have got my friends that were in the Northeast where the, you know, where everything went down at, but no, they got this kid from a way different side of town. I don't know how all that came about where they picked him out of all of us. First, that's still a mystery to us. We're still trying to figure out how that happened.
And then, do you remember when they arrested you?
Oh yeah, I remember that clearly. What happened was earlier that day, we went to these apartments called back then it was called the Village Green Apartments, and that's where we used to hang out. That's one of the hangout spots we used to go to. And so we went there, you know, to hang out, do what we always do. And then we seen these undercover police officers coming in. So when I seen them, I told a friend of mine, I'm like, watch out, because they're probably going to, you know, raid a crack house around here, you know? So that's what we thought. They were just going to raid some crack house around that area. And then we went to our friend's house, Williams. And then from there, you know, we all hooked up. And then everybody was like, hey, well, let's go play some basketball at Irvin High School, which is right behind the apartments. So when we went there, you know, they're playing hoops and stuff. And then these detectives jumped the wall. And then they say, hey, they got a friend of mine named Snapper and then his little brother, which is Williams. And then they got them and they're like, hey, well, you guys meet this. You guys are getting this description that we have of a robbery that happened at this motel. So we're going to take you guys in. So, you know, everybody started talking about, well, you know, they're black. So, you know, you're trying to say all blacks look alike. And, you know, all them comments came out and then they, you know, they got these two kids and they took them away. And then we went back to their apartment and their mother was a nurse. So she would always work different hours. I mean, one day she might work the day shift, next day she might work the night shift. So she wasn't there when we went back to tell her, hey, they just picked up your two sons. And then we're waiting for them. And then it was getting dark. And so I told my friend, I'm like, hey, well, let's, you know, his name was Marcos and he lived with us. He's a street kid. You know, his mom would throw him out and he would live in the streets for a while. So, you know, he was staying at my house at that time and he would be in the street. So I was like, hey, well, let's go to the house. And, you know, I don't think they're going to come back anytime soon. So we went to my house and it was about 9, going to 10 o'clock. And the only reason why I remember the time was because the evening news was coming on, you know, when it happened. So the evening news started coming on and then I was right about to tell my friend, you know, to change the channel. And that's when my mom drove up and then right behind her, all these detectives just bum rushed our house. And then, you know, they broke through the door and then they went straight for my friend. They're like, hey, man, we got an arrest warrant for Marcos Gonzalez and this. And they grabbed him, they threw him down on the floor and they're handcuffing him. And then I was on the phone with one of my ex-girlfriends at the time, Helen. And so I dropped the phone and I got up. And then when they're walking out, I stopped the detectives and I tell them, hey, man, you know, do you even got an arrest warrant or what, you know? You know, because if you don't, you know, you need to unhandcuff them. So they asked me, well, what's your name, kid? And I'm like, oh, Daniel Villegas. And then they're like, hey, man, we've been looking for you too. And they tackle me down.
Did you know why? Did you know why they were there in the first place?
No, I didn't have a clue. I mean, even when they were saying his charges, I was like, what the heck? So, you know, they handcuffed me and they hauled me out.
I understand that you made a false confession.
Okay, well, what happened was, like I said, as soon as they handcuffed me and they were putting me in the car, you know, they already were threatening me at that moment. You know, we got you, little punk, you know, you're a punk-ass bitch, you know what I'm saying? You want to pull triggers and, you know, this and that. And at this whole time, I'm confused. You know, I'm like, what the heck? You know, I'm thinking in my mind, what the hell is going on? And so I'm trying to think, like, you know, what are they talking about? I'm trying to think of this and this. They're throwing me these days, like, you know, this and this date. And, you know, you got to remember that this was already 2 weeks after the crime was committed. I'm trying to think, well, you know, what was I doing on these dates? You know, I wasn't going to school at the time, so it's not like I knew what day was what. I mean, at that moment, if you would ask me what day was it, I probably would be like, ah, shit, I don't know. Let me look at the calendar, you know? So I'm wrecking my brain trying to figure, you know, what's going on. And then they throw me into the cop car and then they take me away and we stop at the North Park Mall and they all the cops hook up and then they come out the car, they talk and then they get back in the car and then they take us. And then this whole time they're telling me I'm going to jail. So I'm telling the detectives, I'm like, look, I can't go to jail because I'm a juvenile, right? And they're like, oh, no, you're not a juvenile, you know what I'm saying? Saying right here, you're 17, you're considered an adult in the state of Texas. So I'm like, no, look at my record. You know, it's a mistake. I'm a juvenile. I don't know what you guys are talking about. And then we're going back and forth with this. So we go to the headquarters, of the police station in El Paso, and at the time that was right down the street from exactly where I live right now. It's on the street called Piedras. And then they go in there and then they check the record, I guess. They come back and then the guy, the detective, was like, you know, I see him, you know, come around the corner running, and he's whispering urgently, but I can barely hear some of the words, not all of them. And, you know, he's telling this guy, hey, man, this guy's a juvenile. He needs to be in a detention center, and we can't bring him here, you know? So we get back into the car, and they take me away to the juvenile detention center. So then from then on out, they offer me a Coke and stuff and try to play the good guy, you know? And they're telling me, hey, man, well, you know, we know you did this, you know, this, your cousin said this and this, you know, Williams is saying this and that. And then I'm like, what the hell's going on? Because he's a, you know, my cousin, he's like a brother to me. I mean, even to this day, he's like a, you know, he's, you know, we're always real close. You know, he was a single kid at the time. And he always stood every time. He stood like his vacations and his weekends, you know, every moment he could, he would stay at our house. So we're, you know, and our parents, you know, my mom and his mom, which is our sister, they're really close. So, you know, we always had this really tight relationship, where, you know, like we didn't see each other as cousins. We saw each other as brothers. You know, he just lived at a different house. So that was like, mom, it was like really mind boggling. Like, what the hell? Why is he saying this? And what the hell are you talking about? And so I'm steady telling the police officers, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, I don't know. And then so when they see mad, they start, you know, they're handcuffing me to the back of the chair. You know, they had me handcuffed back because they, let me rewind this bit. I was handcuffed when I got arrested, and then I was handcuffed when I went there. And then they left the handcuff go so I can drink a soda when they were playing the good cop. And then when I wasn't being cooperative, they put the other hand behind me and handcuffed me again. And then so this detective, what he did was he had a ring. It was, you know, them like a high school ring.
Mm-hmm. Like a class ring?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I just don't know if it was that class ring or if it was or what. But it was the same form and everything, because a lot of these people here have the same ring, but they're like Knights of Columbus or the Masons or whatever, you know. So I can't, I'm not going to say it was a high school ring, but it was one of them type of rings. And he flipped it to where, you know, the pointy part was in his, you know, in the inside of his palm. And he starts slapping me with that, you know. And he's like, we know you did it, punk. We know you did it. And, you know, so I'm going through this back and forth. I don't know what you're talking about. And then this goes on for hours. You know, so at the end, man, I mean, I'm not even like, this is the first time I've ever been really arrested and interrogated, and I was exhausted, and I was just like, whatever, you know. So he was like, well, let's, you know, make this statement. So I start telling them, you know, I just start making up some stuff.
At any point, had they asked you if you wanted an attorney?
No, at none of the point. None of the time did they ask me if I needed an attorney or if my parents were going to be present. None of that. So I make up a story, and he doesn't like it. So what he does is he takes a story, crumples it up, throws it to where the trash can's at, and he's like, you're fucking lying. And he starts beating me again. And, you know, And I don't even know if I can say half the stuff he said on this podcast, but, you know, he was telling me all kinds of stuff about, you know, taking me to the desert and whipping me and taking my clothes off and having me walk back naked. And I mean, it was terrifying.
I am so infuriated on your behalf right now.
I mean, it was terrifying. So after hours of this, he types up a statement. And then he told me to sign it. He says, hey, sign this, and you'll go home, you know? It was all a mistake, you know what I'm saying? You're this and that or whatever. And so I signed it just to get away from these people. And then they say, okay, so then they take me in, and then they take me to a detention center. And then this is one of the points where that detention officer, that was the intake officer, was supposed to ask me, you know, are you threatened? Are you, know, are you doing this? He never asked me none of these questions. All he did was he said, these detectives told me that you're going to go with them and make a statement. Is that true? And so I'm like, yeah. And then he's like, okay. And he walks right out. And then the detectives grab me, put me in the car, and then they take me to a magistrate. And the magistrate is supposed to tell me all my rights and stuff, but he doesn't do it. I mean, he starts mumbling. If you hear the court records, you can see the way this guy talks. Even 24 years, 23 years later, they brought him on the stand again on my writ of habeas corpus. And I mean, even when he's talking then, I mean, you can hardly really understand what the guy's saying. You know what I mean? He got like a monotone voice that's just like, it's real low, and you just can't understand what he's talking about. So he reads a paper to me, and he tells me, sign there. So then I sign it, not knowing what I'm signing, and I go off. They take me back to the police station. And then from then on, we go to this other guy's house named Popeye. That's what we used to call him. His name was Enrique. And they tell me, well, we know he lives in this house, so I want you to affirm it. So we go to his house. And then when I see it.
The police takes you to his house?
Yes. They take me right after the statement, they take me to his house. And then they tell me, is that where he lives? And I'm like, I don't want to put Enrique in the mix, right? So I'm like, I don't know. So they're like, well, hold on. They got out the car. They go to the other vehicle that was in front of us. They talk. The detective comes back in the car and he says, we got confirmation. That's where he lives. So I'm like, okay. So then they take me to a D home. And then I was processed in. And then by the time everything was over with, I mean, it's already, like I said, it was about 10. By the time everything was over with, I got processed and everything. It was already going on, like, 5:30 in the morning.
So you had been awake for so long, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was on a probation. I was on a what they call a first offender program for because I had a criminal trespassing charge at this place called Boomerang. It's a movie theater, right? I was on probation for that on that misdemeanor case. So my probation officer had showed up, and she had talked to me, you know, and she was telling me, hey, well, they're accusing you of this. And I told her at that moment, man, hey, man, I didn't do this. I just did whatever it said. These guys said I was going to go home if I signed that piece of paper. And, she made her report and she left. And from then on out, I was fighting this case.
Were you held in a juvenile center?
Well, I had to get they took me to a certification hearing. But before we get into that, I want to also make this statement, though. These detectives, okay, remember how I told you there were four individuals, right? And then two survived, and then two died. Well, even the survivors, when they first got arrested, right, one of them was called, one of the victims was named Jesse Hernandez. And he was interrogated by my same detective, the same detective that got me. And he had this guy confessing to the crime, basically, almost to the point. The only thing that saved him was that his mother found out about it, called in and said, hey, I don't want you talking to him. That's my son. He ain't going to talk to nobody until he gets a lawyer. That's the only thing that saved this guy. And he was the victim, you know. And but we didn't even find this out till like 23 years later. Can you believe that?
Wow. To have such tunnel vision that you're going to bully the victim into naming.
Exactly. And they were trying to say that, he had him killed for a beeper and a watch.
And then how long before your trial?
The first one, my parents had they had to put a mortgage up for the home, and we got a lawyer. And at that time, it was $20,000, and that was very expensive for us. We couldn't afford that. They had to get like a lot of money out of cars and stuff, visas and whatever, to pay that guy. Jaime Olivas, he was just an up-and-coming lawyer. I get certified as an adult, and then I go to jail. And what was crazy about that too is that day that I was getting certified, my mom, they let me talk to my mom a little bit before the court hearing. And then my mom was like, don't worry about it. We didn't want to tell you nothing because we didn't want you stressing. But, Marcos, the guy that I told you about that was staying with us, he was 17. They're like, He just got let out of jail 2 days ago because they said insufficient evidence. And then Rodney Williams, that's the other guy that got arrested. Remember I told you about Williams, the one they picked up at the basketball court? They're like, and he just went to a certification hearing this morning, and you know, they dropped all charges on him. So that's what my mom was trying to tell me. Like, she was trying to comfort me, you know, hey, you know, so, and it wasn't so much comfort. She also thought it was the truth. You know, she's like, you guys are innocent. You know, they let these two guys go that got arrested with you. You know, you're going to be okay. When we go to court, you know, in about an hour, you know, they're going to see it, and they're going to let you go just like they let these guys go, you know? And it was the wrong mistake. I went to a certification hearing, and then they end up certifying me as an adult, and they take me out of the juvenile custody and put me in the county jail.
How long did you have to wait before you got your criminal trial?
I waited for the first trial about, I want to say, maybe, let's see, about a year for the paid attorney, right? And then we went to trial, and then we had a hung jury. And then after that, you know, by this time I'm already out. I stood in county jail maybe about a little over 90 days. And I got out on bond because I wasn't indicted. So in Texas, they had a law, you know, if you don't indict them, you either drop the charges or let them on a bond. So they put me on what they call a PR bond. And it's like a probation type bond. And so I was waiting out in the free world after 6 months of incarceration, 3 months in the juvenile detention facility, and then about a year, like I said, a little over 3 months in the county jail. And then we went to trial, and we got that hung jury, and then our lawyer came back, and he was like, okay, you know, don't worry about it. 3 months from now, we'll have the charges dropped. So we're thinking, okay, we believe in the system. You know, we'll have the charges dropped. They're going to see that I didn't do this.
How old were you at that time?
At that time, I was 17. When I got arrested, I just turned 16. So then we go there, and then, and so when he's asking, he's like, so all of a sudden we get these papers saying we have to go to trial again. He says, oh my God, well, we're going to have to go to trial again, this and this. And, you know, I have to charge you more money. You know, what you paid me is already, you know, I already did. And we didn't have the money for that. You know, I mean, we're still up to our eyeballs in debt for the, you know, for paying them that first time. So we couldn't pay him. He asked the judge, you know, I was applying for indigent lawyer, you know, and he asked the judge, well, you know, let me be his lawyer. You know, I already know the case. I went to trial for this, and the judge denied it. She denied the request to be, you know, court appointed. And then she gave me this guy named, Gates, Mr. Gates. So I ended up getting with this guy. And then when we first met him, we thought he was going to be okay. Because we had all these witnesses. We had my alibi saying where I was at that night. At the time, we were showing exactly, you know, there's no way that I could have been at two places at the same time. There's no way, even if the alibi story is, even if I can detour from that alibi story and go to that, you know, where the murder happened, there's no way I can reach that and come back and meet all these alibi witnesses where they seen me at that time. You know what I mean? So he's like, I'm going to call all these witnesses, and this is what we're going to do, and it's going to be great. So then when we get to trial, he called no witnesses, but one guy. And it's, you know, the witness he called was, he was a marksman expert that we had in our first trial. That's the only witness he called. And, you know, that marksman expert was saying, you know, the way the statements are saying, you know, there's no way in hell that shot could have been made. You know, and that's the only witness he called. And then it was a 2-day trial, and 2.5 hours later, I was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to 35 years to life in prison.
I am constantly trying to add more podcasts to my playlist. And since you're like me and probably like true crime, I want to tell you about a new podcast called Serial Killers. It takes a psychological and entertaining approach to providing a rare glimpse into the mind, methods, and madness of the most notorious serial killers to better understand what makes them tick. And you even learn some little-known facts. With audio from the real serial killers themselves and the help of voice actors and a production team of screenwriters, we get to delve deeper into the lives and stories. Check out the episodes covering H.H. Holmes, Eileen Wuornos, or Ted Bundy now. Plus, with the new episode coming out every Monday, you can expect episodes on The Zodiac Killer and more in the near future. Just visit iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast directory and search for Serial Killers. Again, Serial Killers. Or visit Parcast.com/serial to start listening right now. That's Parcast, spelled Parcast.com/serial to listen now. I hope you love it as much as I do. I love shopping at Spring.com. It's so convenient to not even have to leave my home to get the best deals on my favorite fashion, beauty, and lifestyle brands. It's so easy, and the shipping is free. Spring is the digital shopping destination for over 1,500 brands. No more having to visit multiple stores or sites to find your favorites. They have brands like Smashbox, Tory Burch, and Marc Jacobs. You can also download the Spring app in the App Store or go to shopspring.com now to start saving on all the latest fashion and lifestyle trends. Get free shipping and free returns on your spring purchases with no spending minimums. And as an added bonus, use my code INNOCENCE at checkout to take 20% off your first purchase. You can see the website for more details. That's shopspring.com or shop through the Spring app and use code INNOCENCE. Find exclusive sales and discounts on all the latest trends and styles you'll love. How did you feel like at that moment when you caught your sentence?
I was in total disbelief. I mean, I couldn't believe this was happening. You know, I believed in our system. I believed that, you know, I was, you know, and I still am gung-ho American. And, you know, I believe that our system does work, you know, so I know it. But now I just know they got flaws in it that we have to work on. But I was in shock. I was like, I don't believe this is happening to me. It was kind of like, have you ever had one of them deja vu experience? That's exactly how I was like. It was like I was there, but I wasn't there.
Like out of body.
Exactly, and I'm like, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, no, this ain't really happening. I have to be dreaming. And then when she read the sentence and stuff, I was like, man, I was still in disbelief. And if you look, they got some pictures of me when I got convicted, and then pictures in the news. Those pictures, I mean, they just, you know how they say a picture describes 1,000 words? I mean, those pictures describe exactly how I was feeling. You know, I mean, you can't get no clearer than that picture right there that they published at that time in 1995. I mean, I was in shock. I couldn't believe it. And it didn't really, like I said, it didn't hit me till when, like in our county, like from the courthouse, you have to go underground to the county jail. Because if the courthouse and then the county jail is right across the street. So even when they put the handcuffs on me and stuff, I was just in total shock. My parents are trying to hug me and kiss me and stuff. And I'm not even responding to them. I'm just, you know, I couldn't respond to nothing. I was just in total shock. So finally, when they handcuffed me and they take me downstairs, and then we go through that underground tunnel, and I hear the first door slam, and it was just like a boom, and it was a metal door. And when I hear that door slam, I freaked out. It like got me out of my daze, right? And I jump and I turn around, and the sheriff, you know, it was a woman, right? And she pushing me. She's like, hey, you little fucker, keep on going, man. And that's when reality hit me, that I was like, holy crap, I'm here. I just got convicted for a capital murder for life. And then from then on out, when on the way from that first door to the county jail, you know, every step, the reality just was becoming more clear and clear.
So what prison did you end up going to?
I went to a lot of prisons. My first one was, and to show you how naive I was with the system at the time, right, I'd been in jail for, you know, a little less than 45 days. And they call my name on the speaker, and they're like, even because my lawyer tells me, he's like, hey, man, we'll get you out in 45 days. Well, we're gonna put a pill and this and this. We'll get you out of here. So, you know, it's all close to 45 days, and they call me in the intercom. They say, hey, Daniel Villegas, B&B. And B&B in El Paso County Jail means that you're going home. I don't know exactly what B&B stands for, but when they say B&B, that means that person is heading out the door. So I'm thinking, oh, yeah, man, B&B, man. So the appeal went through, and they see that I'm, you know, that I was wrongfully convicted. I'm coming home. So, you know, I give all my stuff away, and I'm walking out the door, and then I see a bunch of, you know, marshals coming in, and they're like, you know, they're putting the handcuffs on me and stuff. I'm like, what's going on? They put me in a room, in a little holding cell, and I happen to have a couple of friends in there. And I told them, I'm saying, nah, man, all you guys are going home? And I'm like, that's great, man. And they're like, nah, bro, we're going to prison. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, this is you are too, man. This is the bus to prison, bro. We're they call it the Bluebird. Yeah, I was like, are you serious? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, my God. And, yeah, sure enough, that wasn't the ticket home. That was a bus ticket to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice System. We go to these transfer facilities in Texas. So I go there. I stay there a few months. And then they ship me. And then those is where they, you know, they do like a psychological test on you. They do your IQ test. They do all them testings. And then they kind of figure out where they're going to put you at, right? It's like a holdover. So I go through all that. And then they finally ship me to my prison. So I go to Huntsville, Texas. And they tell me, okay, well, you're going to go to Brazoria. And I'm like, okay, the claimants unit, that's where we're shipping it to. So I'm like, okay. So when I go back to my tank, I tell the guys, I'm like, they're like, hey, where are you going to go to? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to Brazoria County. And everybody's like, oh, my God, are you serious? And I'm like, what's wrong with that? And they're like, oh, man, you don't realize, man, that's a gladiator farm, man. That's, oh, man, you got to be fighting every day there. And I'm like, what the hell? And they're like, yeah, that's what they sell. That's what they ship all the screw-ups, all the youngsters, man. Everybody that's a mess up goes to those are the worst ones you can go to. That Brazoria is the worst one. I'm like, oh, my God. So sure enough, they put me in a box and they ship me to the prison. And when I get there, you know, they inventory our property, whatever. And then I get off the bus. And then, you know, the officer comes in and he grabs us. And then right when we're walking in the prison, he stops us. There's 15 of us. And I remember because I counted every inmate. By this time, my mind frame is I'm stuck in here. I have no belief in the system. I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. So I got to go on pure survival mode. You know, I got to make it, you know, I got to be the best at whatever I got to do to make it in this prison tenure. You know what I mean? So I was on pure survival. I mean, I had no really train of thought or nothing. It was nothing but just think about an animal that's out in the wild. They're just running on instincts. That's exactly what I was running on, just nothing but instinct. They're going to make me go to the gladiator farm with a bunch of gorillas and stuff. Because that's what we used to call everybody, gorillas. Those were the guys who would take over, you know, take advantage of people and rape them and all that. You know what I mean? So I'm like, no, I'm not going to be one of them victims. So, you know, I'm going to have to go on straight gorilla mode. So when we get there, you know, we're walking in, the officer stops us and he says, look, I'm going to tell all you little motherfuckers this. You know, when I open this door, you know, every one of you guys are going to get your ass kicked. Half of you guys are going to get raped and maybe one or two are going to come out dead in the morning. When you wake up in the morning, don't come crying to me or my officers because we ain't your mama, we ain't your papa. You shouldn't have done whatever you did to commit the crime. You shouldn't have came to this place. Welcome to the burning hell. And then he opened up the door and let us in.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was true to his word. I mean, as soon as I walked in there, you know, these guys hit me up and they're like, hey, where you from? And I told them, you know, I'm from El Paso. And they're like, hey, there's your people there. And then so I walked to these guys that they pointed out to. And then and I was like, hey, what's up, guys? Man, I'm from El Paso. And then this guy punches me in the face. And then three guys start clicking on me. They start beating me. And then what they're doing is everybody in the day room is yelling out, you know, rape them, you know, knock them out and fuck them, you know, rape them and all this. I mean, they're yelling out. It's, the guards see this, they walk away, they don't care. And so I'm fighting. And at the same time I'm fighting, I'm praying to God. I'm like, look, God, I can take an ass whipping all day long. Just please don't let them knock me out because I don't feel like I can't take any rape, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, that was over with. And I'm like thinking, okay, this is over with. And then three other guys come to me and they're like, look out, little homie. This all can be over with, man. All can be over with, man. You just got to, you know, you got to bust or fuck. That bust means you got to pay protection or, you know, fuck you. You know, you're going to be somebody's girlfriend. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to be none of that, man. And so they click on me. And then the yelling starts again and all that. And then after that's over with, I'm thinking, okay, well, this got to be the end, right? No, it wasn't the end. Three other guys come at me. And then the whole process starts again. And then after that, I'm thinking, no, this is not going to stop. But by that time, it stopped. And then they were like, okay, man, you passed the first test. And so they're like, okay, man, we're just trying to see if we're going to break you, man. You didn't break. You're good to go. And they're like, hey, man, you know, this is a list of things, man, that, you know, when you go to your cell, if your cellie does any of these things, you have to fight them no matter what. So I'm like, okay. So I go to my cell. And then my cellie does like four things on the list that they said to fight him for. And you got a picture of this big old black guy. And I'm like, you know, he's probably like 6'2", maybe 268 pounds, solid muscle. And at that time, I was 5'7", maybe 150, 150 pounds at the most. And so I see that. I'm like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding. I'm already beat up. You know, black eyes and everything. My eyes are swollen. I can barely see. And I'm like, oh, hell with it. So I just swing at the guy. And then, you know, there's another fight. And then, yeah, that was my inauguration into the, you know, the burning hell. During my time in prison, I really didn't have faith in God or anything. I didn't want nothing to do with God at the time. At the time, I lost all my faith. I was in a dark spot in my life. I was like, if there's a God and a God actually exists, there's no way in hell I would be in prison for something I didn't do. You know what I mean? I had that attitude. When I prayed for faith was actually when I was, that's when things started coming towards my way. It was already probably, I want to say maybe, it was about 16 years.
After you'd been in for 16 years?
Exactly, yeah. It was about 16 years after incarceration, you know, and...
Did your prayer get answered?
Yeah, in fact, like I said, I was waiting for an answer. You know, I went through all my, I came back to El Paso. They granted me a hearing to see if there were, you know, it's called an 1107. It's a court of habeas corpus, and you hardly ever get one of these hearings. I mean, it's unheard of that you actually come back to the county jail and get these hearings. Usually, it's all done by paperwork. But the judge granted a hearing, and I came back to El Paso, and we went through all of that hearings. We went through everything again, and I've been in the county jail probably about 2 years, about a year and a half maybe. And now we're waiting for the answer. We just started waiting for the answer. And I was put in solitary confinement at the time.
Yeah, so like protective custody.
Right, because they were saying that this was such a high-profile case that, you know, we fear that your life will be in danger to be out in population. So they put me in solitary confinement, which was one of the worst things they could do to somebody, because being stuck in a cell by yourself with a bunch of other people screaming all around you, it's not what you want, you know? You want to be out where you can communicate, where you can, you know, mingle, and you can, you know, kind of get away from being locked up, you know? So I was going through hell, and I wasn't used to that. You know, because I mean, I've been in solitary confinement prison for a lot of years, but, you know, I was already, it's been years since I've been back in that type of position. So I was driving me nuts. And I prayed for faith. I was like, you know what, God, I know you're going to get me out of here. You know, I know it, you know, it's all in your timing. But, you know, all I want you, you know, all I'm asking is just give me faith, man. I'm really low on faith right now. I need faith to carry on. You know, I have belief in you. Just, you know, help me out with the faith. And oddly enough, 15 minutes after that prayer, you know, the officer comes to me and says, hey, Viegas, you got mail. So he gives me the letter. And I look at the envelope and it says Faith. I got a letter from a girl named Faith who ended up being my wife.
My name is Amanda Faith. And most people go by Faith. I wrote him a letter of support. And in the best, I guess, the best timing that he needed, he got a letter from Faith.
I think that's an amazing story. So how often did you write or talk, or how did that go?
Okay, so I was a single mom living in an apartment with my daughter. She was 3 at the time, and I was flipping through the news, and I was flipping through the TV channels, and I saw a news station, and I saw my cousin Michelle. And on TV, on the local news, and I was like, what is Michelle doing on the news? So I messaged her. I got a hold of her, and I said, what were you doing? Because I didn't listen to the whole story. I just saw her, and I was like, whoa, what the hell? So I messaged her. I was like, what's going on? Why we're on the news? Is everything okay? And she told me the story of her brother. Well, let me just clarify, my cousin Michelle is not actually my cousin by blood. She's actually married to my cousin. To my cousin Adam is married to Michelle, which is Daniel's sister. So she told me, I have a brother who's in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And I said, well, why didn't you ever tell us this? I mean, you've been married to my cousin for so long. I mean, I've never heard about your family. And she said, well, I mean, I got tired of telling people he didn't do it, because whenever you hear someone say, I didn't do it, everyone rolls their eyes and they don't believe it. She's like, I didn't want to tell anybody, but I mean, it's coming to the point where we're coming with another trial. We're trying to fight his case. And she told me his story, and I was like, well, what can I do to help? I want to help. What do you need? She said, you know what, just write him a letter of support. That's all I want you to do. Just write him, let him know we're supporting him. So I did, and that's when he got my letter. And
so how did that feel, Daniel, to get to pray for faith and then get a letter that was from someone who had the name Faith?
It was mind-boggling. It was like, what? I mean, I laughed to myself. I mean, even when I wrote it, our first letter, we got the letter right here in front of you. Like, you want to read it for verbatim. But even when I wrote it, the letter, I was like, you know, God has to have a sense of humor, you know, because I prayed for faith. And then I get a letter from, you know, a girl named Faith 15 minutes afterwards. You know, and it's the strange thing. I mean, it was strange, but I was starting to get accustomed to this type of thing, because I also prayed when I was in prison. You know, I went to solitary confinement for getting into a confrontation with a guard over my cellmate, because my cellmate was working and he was going to school, and he had missed commissary, and then the guard was slamming the doors. He was doing an improper in and out. You know, in and out is where you go into your cell and you come back out, right? And they do that every hour in the hour. It's 5 minutes. They put you in the cell. They put you so you can grab your stuff, and then you can come out. Well, this guy was talking in the front, so he's doing it in and out like 5 seconds. So if you're not out in that 5 seconds, then you're screwed, in other words, right? So I got into a conversation with the guard over that. I'm like, hey, man, this guy's been working all day. After work, he goes to school. He already missed commissary, and then you want to mess him out of his shower too? I mean, come on. And so we got into that, and then they locked me up. And then after that, I came out. And by this time, I had 12 years in prison. So when I came out, I solitary confinement. You know, I finally, this is when I made my peace with God. I was like, you know what, God, man? You know, I already know, you know, I'm not going to ask you for no favors, because, you, you know, because we haven't been in good terms. Basically, I'm talking to God like I'm having a conversation, in other words, right? And I said, but all I want to know is if I'm going to come home, if all this is for a reason, you know, and if it is, give me a sign. And if it's not for a reason, then give me a sign also, because I'm not going to deal with this. I'm not going to stay in prison I had 12 years. I had another like 20 something years to go to and make parole. So, you know, they're not going to give you your first parole. So I was thinking, I have another 30, 40 years to go. I'm not going to be in prison for that time. I'd rather just commit suicide and end my life, you know? The next day, all right, I get a letter from John Mambella, you know, who's not an attorney. He's not an innocent worker. He was married to my brother's ex-wife. And, you know, he's a successful businessman in El Paso. And then I get a letter from him, and he says, hey, man, I'm going to go, you know, they told me your story, and I'm going to get your lawyer, and I'm going to get you out of here.
Wow. Did you believe him?
At the time, no, I didn't. I was like, this guy is naive, you know, but I thought that's my sign, you know?
Wait, I need to go back to the love story for a minute, because I'm kind of a love story girl. At what point did it become more than just like friends? At what point did you realize that it was more than a friendly relationship?
It just kind of fell into place, you know? We just started writing, and then all of a sudden, two letters into our writing, right? The second letter, John Mambella, my parents, everybody was going out of town. You know, my parents and them were going to Dallas to watch Dallas play, and John Mambella and them were going to L.A. to watch the Raiders play football. So I had an open slot on my visitations list. So I told my sister, I was like, hey, man, you know, I need somebody to fill in them spots. You know, ask Amanda if she'll fill it in. But if she does, she has to go Saturday and Sunday, because I got to get out of the cell. So she said, okay, let me talk to her. And then she talked to Amanda. Amanda said, yeah, I can do Saturday and Sunday. You know, so then when she asked Faith that, you know, and then she came back and told me, I was like, great. So I put on the invitation list. Have in mind, I don't know how she looks like, okay? They call me for the invitation. I tell the officer, I'm like, well, how does she look like? And like, what do you mean, how does she look like, man? You got on your visitation list. I'm like, yeah, no, but I don't know how she looks like. You know, I met her through letters, yet I have never seen her or picture of her yet. So he gets all excited. He's like, well, let's go see how she looks like. So then we're walking, and then, you know, we're looking through all these windows, and then all of a sudden we see, you know, this beautiful woman start waving, and then he's like, this must be her. So I'm like, okay. So I walk in there, and I'm still kind of leery, like, I don't know if this is her or not. I pick up the phone, I say hello, and she's like, hey, how you doing? And, yeah, I mean, the rest was history from there. Like I said, we really don't know when it became official. It was just, we just bonded, you know?
What was that first meeting like for you, Faith, the first day you saw him in person?
Well, let me tell you, I was very nervous because this guy had already done so much time in prison. I was a single mom, struggling paycheck to paycheck, and I was like, this man is gonna lecture me about my life. What have you done these past years? Why haven't you done this? Where are you going in life? And I was so scared. So when I first saw him, he sat down, and you know, I was just myself, and it was instantly like we had just known each other forever. We were just, he was cracking jokes. He was laughing. He was smiling. And I was like, oh my God, I feel like this is just a great connection. You have to think this whole time that he was locked up, he was raised from 16. He was raised by murderers, by rapists, by horrible people. But he had this attitude so opposite from it. And I don't know, we just clicked, and all my stress about that first meeting instantly went away. And we were just like connecting, just laughing and joking. And he says his chest story is he unbuttoned his jumpsuit to show me a tattoo, because he saw my tattoo on my arm. And he's like, oh, I have tattoos. And he showed me the one on his chest, and I was like, whoa, he was ripped up. Nice looking abs. I didn't even notice the tattoo. And he says that's when we fell for each other, but no, it wasn't. But after that meeting, I mean, it was history. We were just connected. I mean, the very first letter I got from him, I got it in the mail. I couldn't even drive 2 minutes. I had to pull over to like rip it open and see what he said. I was just butterflies just all over the place, like, oh my God, what did he say? What did he say? And it wasn't even a relationship kind of feeling. It was like a, oh my God, he responded to my letter. You know, I mean, he's an awesome person. We're just each other's best friends, and I love him.
That's amazing. So we're all sitting here talking together now. Daniel, you got out. What were the steps to getting you out?
Oh, them steps were what we call the steps of hell. Actually, from that first letter till my release date was 8 years later. So it wasn't a fast process. But the steps were that we had to hire, you know, like I said, John wasn't a lawyer or nothing. So he hired a lawyer thinking that, you know, once he pays this lawyer, the lawyer's going to see the case, you know, and then say, hey, this guy's innocent. They're going to let him go. And that wasn't the case. So it was him and his wife, my ex sister-in-law, who I consider my sister because, I mean, we were raised together, right? I mean, I've known Lucy since we were kids. So, you know, she lived with me at our house. So he's watching Oprah with him. And they're having Michael Tenfliff, I think his name was. They're watching a story about him on Oprah. And so this guy's actually explaining what it took to get him out. And like, well, we had to hire a private investigator. We had to do this. We had to do that. So he's making notes of this stuff. So he calls our lawyer and he's like, hey, man, do we need a private investigator? And he's like, and the lawyer tells him, oh, yeah, you need one of those, but that's not included in my charge. So John's like, hey, I don't care what the charge is. Why didn't you tell me this in the beginning? So he's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I got this guy I use. So it was like a Walmart security type guy, right? So John's like, well, let me investigate. So like I said, like John's, he's a very successful businessman in El Paso. So, you know, he called his contacts and asked them, you know, hey, you guys know of any, you know, good, any private investigators. He looked at the Yellow Pages and stuff, and actually out of the Yellow Pages he got this private investigator, and rest in peace, he just passed away this year. He got a very good private investigator that was also a police officer for 30 years, and he hired him, Bonilla. And so once he hired him, Bonilla read the transcripts and Bonilla believed in my innocence. He was like, oh man, this guy's innocent. And I know this detective. I used to work with this guy, you know, and I know how he works. Everything this guy's saying is exactly the same tactics that this guy uses. And Bonilla was telling the man, even the words that this guy is saying is verbatim the words that this detective uses. Because I worked with him for so many years, you know? So he got involved, and then, you know, they started investigating. They started going to, you know, going for witnesses and stuff. And then, you know, from then on, it got the ball rolling. And then we ended up having to let that lawyer go because John wasn't pleased with that lawyer. So we hired a different lawyer, Joe Spencer. And Joe Spencer was very, very critical at first, right? He was like, yeah, you know, I know he, you know, you say he's innocent, but, you know, you got to understand the system. And John was like, I don't care about the system. You know, he's innocent. This is America. He's innocent. How come they're not letting him go? And so, you know, they went back and forth with that. So then John, you know, kept talking to Joe. And Joe's like a very, 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 he's like a legend in El Paso as far as for being a very great lawyer, right? But he's not an appeal lawyer. So he told him straight out, you know, I'll take the case, But, you know, I'm not an appeal lawyer. You know, we have to hire somebody else for that. I'm a trial lawyer. And so, yeah, we did that. And then we turned in the brief. And then we went, and sure enough, I mean, we got granted that we're going to actually have a trial. And have in mind that this is a post-conviction trial. So you're not in front of a jury. It's just a judge, right? But it's just like a jury trial, other than the fact that you don't got a jury on the, you know, the judge is going to make the decision.
Yeah, it's just based on that one person.
Exactly. So we go to trial. You know, I mean, the odds of me even getting that after so many years and all that, and then not having DNA was like, I mean, Joe is such a great lawyer that he'll tell you straight out, hey, this is what's going to happen. Joe told John, we got less than 1% chance to even get a hearing. And then John comes to me and lies to me and says, hey, the lawyer said we got 5%, man. But hey, 5 is better than 0. I didn't find out about the less than 1% chance till I got home. So, but God, you know, I guess God, you know, the universe, higher power, whatever you want to put it, you know, came in and we got that, you know, we got that hearing. And so Joe came in, and then it was another 3 years of hell in the county jail fighting that. I mean, I thought that these guys, after so many years, you know, would tell the truth. I mean, half these guys are retired. They don't got nothing to lose. You know what I mean? You know, go on and tell the truth. But no, they didn't. And so we fought. And then, yeah, at the end, you know, we won that. We won the trial. And then, you know, the judge, San Medrano, ruled in my favor. And then sent the recommendation to the Courts of Criminal Appeals. So we're on a waiting period now, right? And it took about a little over a year and a half. Okay, after we went to the habeas corpus, that's what that hearing was, right? It was a hearing of habeas corpus. After that, the judge made a ruling in my favor. He said, hey, man, you know, they violated his rights, you know, so that, you know, that the confession is void. And I rule that, you know, that he gets a retrial. But he doesn't, his decision is not stone. That judge's decision is only a recommendation. So now it goes to a higher court, which is the Courts of Criminal Appeals. So the Courts of Criminal Appeals are telling this judge, you go through this and you tell us what you think. So then he says, okay, well, this is what I think. I think that, you know, not only is that they illegally obtained that statement, but I also think that he's innocent, you know? That was his recommendation. So we go to the Courts of Criminal Appeals, and then it's a 9-panel judge. And my lawyer tells me, hey, man, it's a 9-panel judge. We have to get the majority vote. 3 of them judges don't even count on them. So he's like, you know, these 3 judges, they never go for the convicted felon. Don't even worry about them. We got to get these other guys. We got to get the majority vote. Well, oddly enough, in the state of Texas, I was the first one that have every judge agree.
Wow, congratulations.
Right? And I was like, what? And they all agreed to, you know, that the sentence, they know that the trial was, you know, I had an innocent counsel, but the one thing that they didn't go with was the actual innocence. They just said, okay, well, you know, you deal with that at court. We're just going to, we're going with, hey, this guy was screwed, basically. There was no DNA in the case, you know?
So how long before you got to go home?
After we got that, it was another, we got that decision actually in 2013, kind of in November, December. It was December, right? Yeah, December. And then the state fought us again. And so we had, you know, since the holidays, Christmas and all that, we had to wait till January to actually go to court on my release. I mean, that month and a half was all right. I could deal with that because I already knew that the higher courts had void. So in other words, when they made the ruling, I was not a convicted felon anymore. You know, so it was like I started all, it was like I just got arrested for this case. You know what I mean? So that I was already sure. I was already confident. Okay, well,
right.
I got a very good chance. So I was already. It was that year and a half waiting for that decision that was, I mean, got me all the gray hairs I have now. I was very stressed out waiting on that decision. Once they made that decision, I was like, okay, now I can deal with this. You know, now I can. Okay. It's like I just got arrested. I'm not a convicted felon no more. That jacket of being a killer is off my back. I mean, it was just like a ton just off my shoulders.
Do you remember the day you went home?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. It was a chaotic day. When we went to court on that day, the DA is asking for, like, this bond that was out of control. They're asking for, like, a $3 million bond, and they're showing all these cases, and they're like, hey, man, you know, this is this case and that case, and, you know, this guy was, you know, got this bond for this offense. This guy got this bond for that offense, and they're all in the millions, right? So I'm thinking to myself, you know, sitting there, I'm thinking, you know, even if they give me bond, there's no way I can afford that. You know, even John, you know, being a there's no way he's going to be able to put up that money for that. You know, he's already probably $300,000 on lawyer fees and detectives and everything by this time, right? I'm like, there's no way we can afford that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the judge heard everything. And thank God that, you know, my lawyer, he had like half of the defendants that they had on the board. And he was explaining every situation on the case. So he was like, okay, well, this case, they got this circumstances. This case, they got this circumstances. In this case, they got this circumstances. So, you know, he broke all them cases down. And then, so at the end of the day, you know, the judge gave me a $50,000 bond. $40,000 was PR bond, and then $10,000 was the actual bond. I knew I was going home. I was like, I couldn't believe it. It was like being in a dream. I was like, okay, I'm going home now. So then I'm in the holding cell waiting to come back. And then they take me back to the to get processed out. And the crazy thing about this was when they actually gave me my clothes to put on, you know, from the jumper to free world clothes, as we call them, inmates call it, right? Clothes that you wear out here in the world. They put me in a holding tank, right? The same holding tank that they put me in 1993 to change out my clothes.
Wow, that's irony at its finest.
Exactly, right? Out of 24 cells, there was 24 of them cells that they used. And I got the same one. What are the odds of that?
How did that day feel for you, Faith?
Oh, my God. That was like, I had never touched Daniel because our visitations were through a window. So when he got out and all the media, the cameras, everybody yelling, I heard one of my nieces say, you can touch him now, touch him. And all I could do was poke him with my finger because he was so bombarded by other people. I was just touching him, I was poking him. And there was people jumping over people and just... And I remember Daniel saying, I can smell the rubber. I can smell the rubber, the asphalt from the cement. I can smell it. And that's just things that we take for granted. People who smell that every day were used to it. And he kept saying, I can smell the street. I can smell the asphalt from the ground. And I was just amazed, and it was chaotic. I don't know how famous people do it with paparazzi all day, because at the end of that day, it was exhausting. I was exhausted. I always stay in the background, always. I don't give interviews. I don't talk to people, and I was just in the background watching him.
Well, I feel honored.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, I only did it because I love you. I love podcasts. I love this podcast, and that's the only reason why.
Aww.
But... yeah, I have a few facts, if you don't mind, that I would like to share with you on Daniel's case. His cousin David Rahel shared these with us.
I would love them.
So here's some fun facts in the Daniel Villegas case. Jaime which is our district attorney who wants to convict Daniel, still to this day, to this very day, would rather you not know or forget. So there's no forensic evidence. There's no DNA evidence, no physical evidence. Eyewitnesses, which are the survivors of the shooting, say his confession doesn't match what happened. Daniel's confession was thrown out by Judge Medrano for being illegally obtained and coerced. Our Judge Sam Medrano, after reviewing all the evidence, believes not only does Daniel deserve a new trial, but also believes he's innocent. Daniel Villegas passed a lie detector test. Court of Criminal Appeals judges voted to unanimously overturn the old verdict, which is extremely rare, which he told you earlier. Survivor of the shooting, Jesse Hernandez, is on Daniel's side. And an assistant district attorney that helped Jaime in this trial believes he's innocent. Rudy Flores, the reported actual killer, pleaded the Fifth Amendment during Daniel's hearing when questioned about the murder. That's the person they believe is the actual killer. He pleaded the Fifth Amendment. The judge gave him, I believe, some 5 years extra time for pleading the Fifth because he wouldn't answer questions pertaining to the case. And Jaime Esparza feels that he has a case. That's our district attorney. He's either a very inadequate district attorney or protecting his record for his own selfish needs. Either way, he needs to be removed from the office. That's what I say. He's been a district attorney for years and years and years and years and years. About 24 years, Daniel says. And it's the good old system. People keep voting him in. And that's what I want to tell your listeners is, when they're in this kind of situation, vote, figure out, vote, because you might come into a situation where this happens to you and you need to vote for the right people to be in office to do the right thing. And our district attorney isn't. He fights us every single thing that we do. He fights every single way because he doesn't want to admit to his fault. And at the time, he wasn't our district attorney. He was a district attorney, but he was a brand new district attorney trying to make a name for himself. And he made a name for himself on Daniel Villegas' case. And that's really sad.
How are you guys doing now? Like, tell me about your family. I heard you have a new little person hanging around.
Yeah, we do. A year after he got released, we got pregnant, and we had the first boy in his side of the family, and his name's Jude. Well, we named him after his dad, which is Brasiliano, but his middle name I put as Jude after my brother. So he's almost two. He'll be two in September. He looks just like Daniel. He doesn't have any of my genes. He looks like a little white boy with red hair. I look like the Mexican nanny.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but I love to see Daniel. I mean, I don't know if you know, but when Daniel was convicted, he had a daughter who was 6 months old at the time of his conviction. And she's 22 years old now, and she has a baby. So Daniel's a grandpa. And, yeah, so he's a grandpa with a 18-month-old son, too. So life couldn't be better.
Faith, I have one more question for you and two more for Daniel.
Okay.
What advice would you give to other significant others about how to stay strong while the person that they love is incarcerated?
Okay, that's a good question. What I would suggest is get rid of the negative people in your life. I mean, people thought I was crazy for getting involved with somebody with a sentence of 35 to life. And those people I weeded out of my life, and I kept people close to me that supported me, and I kept busy. And yeah, I kept busy, and I didn't fathom the fact of any other option. I didn't say, well, maybe he might end up not winning his fight and staying in there for life. I didn't want to entertain that thought. I told everybody who questioned me, like, what are you doing dating this guy behind prison? I mean, look at his sentence. I said, no, I'm not going to entertain that thought. He's innocent. You guys don't know the case. So keep yourself around positive people and believe in their situation and believe that they're innocent. Because if you don't, the universe is gonna falter. And pray to God, because God does miracles for you. And keep yourself busy and believe in justice. I don't know about the justice system, but believe in justice. There's so many innocent people out there that need the kind of support that Daniel has, and you just got to stay busy. I am working on a Facebook page to help or to work with wives of people who are in prison or exonerated people, to try to cope with that whole situation. Cause it's hard when they come out, they're not used to the free world, and we have to deal with that. I mean, Daniel came out as a 16-year-old boy. That's what he came out as. And now he's 30. Life is hard, not only for them, but for the person who's with them. And there's a lot of things that Daniel, I was weirded out by. He would pace back and forth. And when he would talk, and he'd be up at 3 a.m. and he, let me tell you a funny story. We were taking a shower once, and he dropped the loofah, and he picked it up with his foot automatically. He didn't bend down to pick it. He picked it up with his foot. And I was like, what are you doing? Why are you picking it up like that? And then he would bring everything inside the shower, everything, his toothbrush, everything. And I was like, wow, this is crazy to deal with. So a lot of women don't know that whole situation. And he came out as a 16-year-old boy, and I had to kind of teach him, like, okay, calm down. You're not a kid's dog anymore. You're an adult. This is how we do it in relationships. This is how it goes.
Right. Good for you. Good for you for being strong and supportive. Like, that takes a lot. And I think that great job. That's all I can say. Like, I can't express, like, how hard that must have been for you.
Oh, thank you. Right, right. It was worth it to me. And when I have a hard day at work, and I'm a mail carrier, and I complain and I cry, but I think about Daniel. I think about his struggle, and he was a gladiator warrior. I don't know if he hasn't told you that yet, but he was a gladiator warrior. They would train him to fight against other inmates for their own purpose, and the guards would get money for it and bet on him like dogs. I mean, this is a horrible justice system that we need to fix. We need to figure it out here, people, and people need to vote. That's another big thing. People need to vote for this to be all fixed.
Okay, Daniel, I have two more questions for you. Are you ready for them?
Okay, yes.
P.S., your wife is a great speaker.
Thank you. Yeah, she's amazing, man.
What advice would you give to someone who finds themselves being accused or convicted of something they didn't do?
First of all, do not talk to detectives. You know, they're not your friends. They're not trying to help you. They're trying to mess you over. So stop that automatically. Ask for your lawyer, ask for your parents, ask whatever it takes to get away from them fast as possible. You know, that's rule number one, because these guys are trained, they're experienced into making you say and making you even to making you think that you may have even blacked out. You know, they make you think that, hey, man, maybe did I black out? Did I do this? I mean, Jesse Hernandez, one of the victims, he even said himself, he was like, they made me actually think that I blacked out and killed my best friend. And years later, I was having dreams about this, you know? They will threaten you to not talk. You just got to stop that automatically. And that is easier said than done. Because when you're in that situation, I mean, it's so hard. Especially an innocent person always thinks, if I tell them the truth, man, this is all going to be over with. You know what I mean? That's your worst mistake. Cannot tell them the truth because they don't want to hear it.
Yep, I've heard that hundreds of times.
They want you to go to prison forever.
So last question, and this is the question that I get all the time from the listeners. What can the average person like me or Joe on the street do to help people who have been wrongfully convicted?
Okay, on that one, if you're in Texas, proclaim justice. I mean, if you can donate money to proclaim justice. I believe you had Jason on the podcast. That's also a director of Folk Center.
Yeah, just last week.
Exactly. Jason is a good friend of mine from the Memphis 3. I mean, he's awesome. I love him. John Hardy. I mean, another director, one of the singers from the Dixie Chicks. She's also a director. I mean, if you're in Texas, I mean, donate money to that organization, ProclaimJustice.org. They are, I mean, the only reason why I say this is because I'm working with them. I'm not a director or anything, but I'm working with them also to help them out. You know, John Mambera, the one who helped me out, he's the director. And we're trying to get these people out of prison. You know, I mean, even remember when we met, you know, at that innocent convention, the first person I brought to you was Jason. I was like, Jason was right there with me. And I was like, hey, Jason, man, you got to do this, man, man. This is for us. This is for all of us innocent people, man, man. Just come on, bro. And Jason stepped up to the plate, man. I mean, he's awesome. He's an awesome guy. Out of every, I mean, the Innocent Project, the Innocent Convention, that was my second one I've been to. I've been to one in San Antonio, and that one was mine and Jason's first one. This is mine and Jason's second. But, I mean, it was just mind-boggling because you're with people that know what you've been through because they've been through the same thing. It's like you're automatically family. But, yeah, do that. If you're not in Texas, you know, what you need to do is find out, you know, what organizations are out there in your state that help the most people that are wrongfully convicted. Because there are so many of us that are wrongfully convicted. Even John Mambela, like I said, he's not a lawyer or nothing, and he never, never imagined that this was actually going, that this was happening, that so many people were wrongfully convicted, you know? Until he got into my case. And now that he got into my case, he sees all these other cases, and then he's going to all these innocent conventions, and he's like, wow, I can't just stop with you. I got to start helping more people. So that's another thing. I mean, you have to, even now, I mean, when I'm on my Harley, and I'm riding, and I live in El Paso, Texas, where it's like we got these awesome, our mountains made National Geographic, you know? I mean, we got the beautiful scenery out here, even though we're in the desert. And, you know, I'm out there and I'm riding, and I'm passing these mountains, and, you know, and I think about all the other people that I left behind, all the people that are wrongfully convicted are still in prison, and in my mind, I say, hey, man, I'm enjoying this for you guys. You know, I'm living life to the fullest for you guys because I know that you guys can't experience this. And I wish that somehow I could help you out. You know, so, but in actuality, I mean, two of the people that I was locked up with were in Proclaim Justice. We're trying to help out. And we're picking up their cases as we speak. But that's just the thing. I mean, we can't help everybody. You know what I mean? It's crazy how it is, but yeah, if you want to help out, that's what you do. You're whatever state you're in, find out what innocent project is out there. And either, you know, you don't even have to give them money, just volunteer just to go out there, man. Tell these people, hey man, I can't give you money, but you know, I can volunteer my time. You will be surprised. Just when they can say, hey, okay, if you can volunteer your time, hey, man, can you go to the courthouse and pick up this case file for us? I mean, that is a help in itself, you know, because, I mean, picking up a case file is an hour of somebody's time. And in this world, that's a lot of time. I mean, money, whatever, it's just time, your money, just to help out these organizations, because there's so many of us that are still locked behind bars. You went to this convention. Did you see how many convictions, wrongful convictions we had? We had over 2,000, right? We had, I think we had 290 people that were there of the wrongful convicted. That's not even 25%. That's crazy. And then you got to think about how many more are still in there. You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling. So if you want to help out, yeah, find out what's your local, in your state. If it's not your city, go to your state and help out with your time or donate. And because we sure need that, you know, we need that.
Well, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me tonight.
Okay. Amanda just wants to talk to you real quick before we go.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Hi. I just wanted to say a big thank you to Ryan Ferguson. I know you haven't had him on his podcast, on your podcast, but
it's not for lack of trying.
Well, yeah, you definitely need to. Yes, Ryan Ferguson, Anthony Graves, I know you've had him on there. He's a good friend of ours. Richard Rosario, Amanda Knox is a friend of ours, and Chris Ochoa. I mean, these people have been there for Daniel and helped him out a lot in his struggle. And we're still fighting. And next time you talk to us, hopefully this will all be done with. And I just want to say thank you so much for your podcast. And it's doing so much for people. And it's giving people hope and faith. And thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
We appreciate you.
Yeah, we do. This is awesome. That's why when I first heard you, I had to do it.
Here's the trailer I mentioned about my new podcast. You've heard the names before. Daryl Massey, Fred Hanna, Christina Gutierrez. You know the location. But have you heard this name?
This call is from
Richard Nicholas,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility. This call will be recorded and monitored.
A 2-year-old girl was murdered.
From moment one, she just laughed and smiled. She was a beautiful baby. And nothing mattered but getting to know her. And she was just like a ray of light. I mean, she was just a breath of fresh air. She was just, oh my gosh, she was like an angel.
And her father was convicted. Did you kill her?
No, I did not. I did not shoot my daughter.
Subscribe now to Convicted, coming late April. More information at convictedpod.com. A special thanks to our sponsors, Blue Apron, Serial Killers, and Shop Spring, for sponsoring today's episode. Remember, if you can't financially support our sponsors, you can still help by giving them a shout out on social media. Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for more information, and check out our new podcast, Convicted, on your favorite podcast app. Our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks again, and always, for listening.